Dallas Theological Seminary's Chapel Podcast.
Our chapel speaker today is Dr. Chuck Swindoll. He served as the fourth president of Dallas Seminary from 1994 to 2001, and since then he has been the chancellor of Dallas Seminary, and he's also the senior pastor of Stonebriar Community Church in Frisco, which is just north of Dallas. Dr. Swindoll is the featured Bible teacher on the popular radio program Insight for Living, which is aired many times daily around the world. He is also the author of many books on Bible characters and topics for Christian living, plus a new Bible study series entitled Swindoll's New Testament Insights. His warmth, his insight, his humor, and his personal transparency have made him a well-loved pastor-teacher during more than 50 years of ministry. Chuck and his wife Cynthia reside here in the Metroplex, and they enjoy spending time with their four adult children and their 10 grandchildren. And I'd like you to join with me in welcoming Dr. Chuck Swindoll.
I have a question you've never been asked before. Here's the question. Are you terry cloth or wire mesh? Yeah, you heard it right. Terry cloth or wire mesh? Dr. Harry Harlow loved to stand by the animal cages in his University of Wisconsin laboratory and watch baby monkeys. Intrigued, he noticed that the monkeys seemed emotionally attached to cloth pads lying in their cages. They caressed them, cuddled next to them, treated them much as children treat a teddy bear. In fact, monkeys raised in cages with cloths on the floor grew huskier and healthier than monkeys in cages with wire mesh floors. Was the softness and touchability of the cloth an important factor? He wondered. Harlow constructed an ingenious surrogate mother made out of terry cloth with a light bulb inside her to radiate heat. The cloth mother featured a rubber baby nipple attached to a milk supply from which the babies could feed. They adopted her with great enthusiasm. Why not? She was always comfortably available and never roughed them up or bit them or pushed them aside, unlike real mothers. He means monkey mothers, I'm sure. After proving that baby monkeys could be, quote, raised by inanimate surrogate mothers, Harlow next sought to measure the importance of the mother's touchable, tactile characteristics. So he put 8 monkeys in the same cage that contained the terry cloth mother plus a new mother, one made entirely of wire mesh. Harlow's assistants, controlling the milk flow to each mother, taught 4 of the monkeys to nurse from the terry cloth mother, and the other 4 from the wire mesh mother. Each baby could get milk only from the mother assigned to it. A startling trend developed almost immediately. All 8 babies spent most of their waking time, 16 to 18 hours a day, next to the terry cloth mother. They hugged her, patted her, and perched on her. Monkeys assigned to the wire mesh mother went to her only for feeding, and then scooted back to the comfort and protection of the terry cloth mother. When frightened, all eight would seek solace by climbing onto the terry cloth mother, never the wire mesh mother. Harlow concluded, "We were not surprised to discover that contact comfort was an important basic affectional or love variable, but we did not expect it to overshadow so completely the variable of nursing. Indeed, the disparity is so great as to suggest the primary function of nursing is that of ensuring frequent and intimate body contact of the infant with the mother. Certainly," he added, "man cannot live by milk alone." In other experiments, some baby monkeys were raised in cages with only wire mesh mothers. They too approached her only for feeding. Most of the babies did not survive. Those who did reacted to stress by cowering in a corner, screaming, or hiding their faces under their arms. Are you a terry cloth or are you wire mesh? That experiment with baby monkeys, when applied to those of us in ministry, can prove quite convicting. Stop and think. You've been far enough along in your education to have terry cloth professors and wire mesh professors. How about terry cloth pastors as opposed to wire mesh pastors? We've seen both, haven't we? Terry cloth counselors as opposed to those with far less counselees, wire mesh. Terry cloth missionaries instead of wire mesh. While I'm at it, terry cloth husbands and wives, as well as wire mesh. And mothers and dads and friends. What do we mean by terry cloth? Well, when I think of something that is analogous to that, I think of someone who is humble and vulnerable, available and caring, easy to approach, sensitive, and compassionate. And you already know what I would say regarding the wire mesh. Individuals are proud and closed, distant and harsh, critical and judgmental. You will probably be a mixture of both as you enter whatever realm of ministry God leads you into. My plea today is that you be more of the terry cloth and less of the wire mesh whenever possible. Because the terry cloth person in ministry is one who conducts a ministry of refreshment. A ministry of refreshment. It isn't a spiritual gift. It's a spiritual ministry. I have friends like that, and every time I see a piece of snail mail in my box, I smile when I see their name in the corner because I know right away it's going to be a letter of encouragement. There are others, however. I got one yesterday. Who will tell you that you blaspheme the name and work of the Holy Spirit, even though you preach your heart out, and a number of other things that mean you need to shred the letter rather than read the letter. I always say I'm not going to pay any attention to it. Then I memorize it. Isn't that amazing how we are? It's just amazing. Think before you put your critical comment into writing, and certainly don't do it through an email. Do it face-to-face if you have something to say, because not all criticism is wire mesh. Some of it is essential. Faithful are the wounds of a friend, but deceitful are the kisses of an enemy, Proverbs 27:6. So, today I want to talk about the ministry of refreshment. Some of you need to hear it more than others, but let's all listen closely. 2 Timothy chapter 1 introduces a minister of refreshment. His name, at first glance, looks like a misprint. Most Christians could never tell you a one-line description of Onesiphorus. Remember where Paul is. This is dungeon talk. This is dungeon writing. He's in the Mamertine prison, soon to die. He's cold. It's dark. He's lonely. And he's writing his final piece to his good friend, several years younger than he, no doubt more than 20 years younger, whose name is Timothy. Paul doesn't know when he will hear the boots of the soldiers above him, but they're coming. And as soon as they arrive, it will only be a matter of time before his head will be severed from his shoulders. This is dungeon writing. Bishop Moule admitted that each time he picked up to read the second letter to Timothy, his eyes filled with a mist. I always get a chill up my back when I come across certain sections as I remember where Paul is when he wrote the letter. Perhaps all of that gives new meaning to his words in verse 15 of this first chapter. You are aware of the fact that all who are in Asia turned away from me. The origin of the word turned away, translated to this turned away, is the word for apostasy. Could be that they apostatized the faith. It could be that they turned and fled from a friendship. Could be they did that out of fear, because in those days the friend of a criminal lived a very threatened life himself or herself. And so he says that all of the people in Asia, that's the massive country of Turkey and a little bit of Bulgaria, we would see it today. This is a large body of land, and probably the all should be taken in a broad sense, not every single individual, but the great preponderance of them. I don't know if you've ever had that to happen. If you haven't, you will. One person, once close to you, chooses to turn against you. It's disillusioning. John Calvin writes this, that he experienced deep hurts when he was expelled from his ministry in Geneva and abandoned by longtime friends. He later remarked, don't miss this, that such deserters invariably became his accusers. That many of his former colleagues wandered through the streets directing their accusations against him. That's what Paul's referring to. By now he's on the last part of his journey, of course. His mind is filled with memories, and from having helped many people who were dying, the memories often revolve around people. And Paul remembers those who turned away from him, among whom were Phygellus and Hermogenes. We know nothing else about these two individuals. Maybe they led a group. Maybe they were especially close at one time. It certainly proves that Paul's associates are not all named in the New Testament. He has friends that we know really very little about. And here are two of them. But what provides such encouragement in this dark context is his mentioning the person of refreshment. The Lord grant mercy to the house of Onesiphorus, for he often refreshed me. We'll come back to that. It's a key word. He often refreshed me and was not ashamed of my chains. I've always loved that turn of a phrase. Paul is quite likely not only shackled with hands, but also in his legs. It's the word for shackle. Wasn't ashamed of the steel cuffs. The point is, he wasn't ashamed of the fact that I was incarcerated. That's a friend, by the way. If you have a friend who has, for whatever reason, wound up in prison, it is the easiest place to distance yourself from that person. I've shared with you before in years past of my younger son's, one of his closest friends made a foolish mistake on more than one occasion and wound up in Huntsville for 12 years. He so happened to have had a poor lawyer, and the one making the accusation had an excellent lawyer, and they got the maximum sentence. I was always proud of Chuck for taking the time to drive to Huntsville to be with his friend. Chuck would say to me, "Well, Dad, if he ever needs a friend, he needs him now." In your ministry, you will have some who desert. You will have some who fall aside. I hope it will never be named of you, but it will be named of colleagues. Some of your classmates will fall, tragically. The simplest, the easiest thing to do is write them off and talk about them. And I love it that Onesiphorus doesn't do that. By the way, the name itself means one who brings profit, one who is profitable, appropriate for Onesiphorus. He often refreshed me. In fact, he goes on, when he was in Rome, he eagerly searched for me and found me. Rome's a massive city, and since ancient days has been, with all its serpentine alleys and low-lit streets. This man searched him out to find him. Even today, when you visit the Mamertine prison, it isn't easy to find. And many guides don't take the time to show you the place. And when you're there and you walk down into it, a mist sort of fills your eyes as you imagine life in that pit. He often refreshed me. Now the word. The original term comes from the root word that means to cool. Sometime was used for blowing on a wound, as you will often do with one of your children when they've cut themselves, to cool the sting. This word has come to mean to provide relief from trouble. He often provided relief for me. Another definition, to give someone breathing space, to revive, to refresh. It appears only one other time in the New Testament, Acts 3:19, referring to times of refreshing. Refreshing, cooling. Onesiphorus, otherwise unknown, mentioned only in the last chapter of this book, as he refers again to the household of Onesiphorus, causing some to believe that he's now dead. I won't get into that. The point is, his memory is, the memory of him is very much alive. And Paul can call to mind those occasions when he came to him and refreshed him. And don't overlook the term often. In fact, it wasn't just Paul he refreshed, lest it could seem he was a name dropper, close enough to Paul to be in his presence. No, it says, the Lord grant him to find mercy from the Lord on that day, meaning the day of judgment, and you know very well what services he rendered at Ephesus, plural. That's a long ways away. Over there in Ephesus, you know, Timothy, by the way, is what we would call pastoring a church among the Ephesians. I think Timothy knew Onesiphorus well, because I believe he was a minister of refreshment to Timothy and to many others. Kent Hughes writes, Onesiphorus searched hard, treading the passages of Rome, knocking at doors, asking in his provincial accent about Paul, doors slammed shut. Disapproving eyes watched as he continued his search, but he refused to desist. He was asking dangerous questions. The lesser devoted would have made no search at all. Others would have cooled their consciences with minimal effort. He simply couldn't be found. Not this man. Onesiphorus was there for Paul, a friend loves at all times. And a brother is born for adversity. Clarence McCartney put it in these words, adversity is the wind which separates the chaff of flattery from the grain of real friendship. Adversity. Someday you will find yourself in adverse circumstances for whatever reason. You can't imagine right now what it may be, but you'll be there. It's all part of being broken. There's a saying among Australians that I always smile at when I'm down there. I hear it as they refer to big shots that show up. They say, we enjoy cutting down the tall poppies. God cuts down the tall poppies. Some of you are greatly gifted. You're capable. You even struggle with the thought of staying in school because you've been given opportunity for further ministry. Don't quit till you get your studies done. Finish your course. Then you got a lifetime of ministry ahead of you. But you're gifted. You're capable. You'll soon be in demand. But adversity will come. And it will crush you. And when it does, not if but when, you will long for an Onesiphorus to show up. Maybe some long friend from years ago. Maybe someone that's been in your church and has hardly emerged until you've been under the gun and then they come out of the woodwork. I've had a handful of them in my life, and that's the reason I'm still standing. Because they often refreshed me and weren't afraid of my adversity. Sometimes it was adversity that I brought on myself. I am sure that's what David found in Jonathan. I came across a few proverbs that seem to speak to this, and we'll go back to the text in a minute. Proverbs 15:13, a joyful heart makes a cheerful face. But when the heart is sad, the spirit is broken. A man has joy in an apt answer. 15:23. How delightful is a timely word. Don't you love that? Reminds me of another comment in 25. Words fitly spoken are like apples of gold and pictures of silver. As an earring of gold and an ornament of fine gold, so was a wise reprover on an obedient ear. I was reproved last week for something, and while it was hard to hear it, today I'm grateful for the wise reproof. I needed to hear it, and it was spoken at the right time, and it was spoken in private. Proverbs 25:13, this is especially appropriate. Faithful messengers refresh the soul of their masters. Isn't that interesting? Refreshing the soul of the master. You may be employed somewhere. You serve another individual. He or she may own the company. And you're there for a period of time and then you're gone. What a wonderful testimony to have it said of you that you brought refreshment to the company, that your presence was appropriate and encouraging. And that is the way it was with Onesiphorus. The Lord grant mercy to the house of Onesiphorus. Isn't that interesting? A man of mercy, and he asked that the Lord bring mercy to his house. And then having said what he said about what he did in Rome, he goes on to say that he was known for that in Ephesus. Alexander White was 47 years a pastor of the Free Church St. George in Edinburgh. And has written a number of things. I think his best are his Old Testament characters and New Testament characters. And he writes in his volume on New Testament characters these words. Onesiphorus was an elder in the church of Ephesus, and a better elder there never was. A rare and remarkable man. Paul had been Onesiphorus' minister for 3 years. And they had been 3 years of great labors and great sufferings on Paul's part. And you come to know your elders pretty well in 3 years, like Paul's 3 years in Ephesus. So he knew him. But notice, if you will, he didn't forget him when Paul was across the Aegean, across Greece, across the Adriatic, up into south central Italy. That's a long journey. I think at times when I refer to Onesiphorus, he might very well have moved to Rome temporarily to be near his former pastor and longtime friend. All the elders in Ephesus, writes White, all the elders in Ephesus loved Paul and had good reason to love him, but all taken together, they did not love Paul as Onesiphorus did. It was Onesiphorus more than all his colleagues in the eldership who had kept the apostle alive during those 3 years. Many and many a time Paul would have fainted altogether had it not been for Onesiphorus. My message today is really very simple. Because you will be the leader, no doubt, quite likely, the leader in whatever ministry God brings you into, you will quite likely be better educated than most, if not all, the colleagues around you. You will have a mind that's been sharpened in the doctrines. You will know the languages that most of your colleagues will not know. You will be the one who speaks for the ministry, quite likely, if you're the leader. And you will therefore be the most visible. And with that, the most vulnerable. I urge you to cultivate relationships with those around you so that they will know you are terry cloth. They will know that you are vulnerable, you have needs, and you're teachable and available. I think it says a lot for Paul that he was willing to say what he said and to do what he did when Onesiphorus showed up, rather than, oh, no, everything's fine. Doing great. Like a friend of mine in Florida, every time I showed up, I'd say, how are you doing? Fantastic. I could just hear his voice ring around the airport. It was a way to get the luggage. I returned to the little school where he was serving as president the next year. And how are you doing? Fantastic. Not quite as loud, but the same nonsensical answer. Nobody is fantastic unless they are terribly blind. I happen to know what he was living with. By the third year when I was back, his wife had left him, taking the kids. The school was about, I'm going to guess, a tenth of the original size and ultimately went under. I showed up that day, and when I saw him, he just threw his arms around me, broken and hardly able to talk. And I said, well, same question. He said, I'm growing and I'm learning, and I am not fantastic. Paul is growing and learning, but he isn't fantastic. Not a member of this faculty is fantastic. They have needs just as you have needs. They face pressures just as you. They're different pressures, but they've got them. They have wives and husbands. They have families. They have responsibilities. They deal with you. And a lot is asked of them, and I rarely blow smoke on them because I don't want them to think that we kind of sit in awe of them. But every once in a while, when I'm driving to Dallas Theological Seminary, as happened to me this morning, I just thanked him for the profs, some of whom have been here since I was here, many of whom, fine men and women, added since that time. Every once in a while, could you find it within your ability to be a source of refreshment for one of them? I heard a marvelous story when I was serving as president. I would always have the THM guys and women in for a final setting and always ask them searching questions. It was in the president's office, and the door was always closed, and I told them, what happens in this office stays in this office. So talk freely. And one of my favorite questions was twofold. What have you really liked about the school and you wish would even be intensified more, and what do you really not like? It was amazing how often, how do I say this, the names of certain professors emerged among those who were their favorites. Everybody has favorites, so don't look at me like that. And they would say, I'll never forget Dr. So-and-so. And one young student graduating sat there really quietly, and he said, I want to tell you a story, Dr. Swindoll. And I said, great. I love stories. He said, I think it was my third year, and I was just going under. I'm just going under. He said, we were handed our exam, and I sighed, and I just began to weep. He said the professor noticed that. I won't call his name because it would embarrass him. But this man and several others all through those interviews mentioned the same professor, interestingly. He said he walked over to me and he leaned over and he put his arm around me and he said, what's wrong? He said, I began to sob, and I just kind of mixed between embarrassed and grateful that he would take a moment. And he said, he whispered to me, just tell me what's wrong, very tenderly. And the young man said, I don't know if my wife will be there when I go back home. We had a horrendously difficult weekend. Our marriage is not strong. And he's saying this just as quietly as he can because there are other students around. And the professor said to him, give me that exam. So he took the exam and he said, you go home. Your long-term relationship with your wife is far more important than you're taking a test today for this course. And then he just, in our meeting of about 8 or 10 students, he just started to cry. By now, all of us are, you know, kind of choking back the tears. And he said, you know, I'll forget a lot of other things, but I'll never, ever forget that professor. Now, I can just hear some of you thinking, tell me who he was. It could have been any one of these, any one of them. In that moment, that professor was onesiphorous to that student. He refreshed him. He cooled him. And by the way, the good word, since that had happened, I think, about January, February, we were graduating now in April, May. He said, I just want you to know that we were able to keep our marriage together. And I have him to thank because she was packing when I got home. You never know by looking around where the Pauls in prison are. I can never guess in our congregation. And every once in a while, when I stand there till the last person is left, I say to Cynthia on the way home, I had no idea that so-and-so was going through such-and-such. And of course, she didn't either. And I said, frankly, I would have named him as probably one of the stalwarts who hardly has a need. What's involved in being a person of refreshment? Let me click it off and I'm through. Number one is unselfishness. Just being unselfish enough to care about another more than you do yours, your schedule, your life. Second, of course, is availability. You're never an onesiphorus miles away, unless it's by phone. You're most often an onesiphorus face-to-face. You're available. Number three is sensitivity. Your heart can feel the ragged edge of another heart without it needing to be spelled out. You have a sensitive spirit. A fourth would be determination. He often refreshed me. He was often back at this cell. He was often in my presence. He often brought food. In those days, prisoners often died for lack of food. Government didn't feed them. They didn't have friends or family. They died. And I can just see Onesiphorus bringing a basket of food and sitting there with Paul, remembering the great days, anticipating the future together with the Lord. Determination. Finally, of course, would be compassion. Compassion. One more time, I'll walk through words of Alexander White and I'm through. Paul might be the greatest of the apostles to Onesiphorus. He may be all that and far more than all that to you and me. But he was only number so-and-so to the soldier who was chained there to him. You would not have known Paul from any other convict in his own penal settlement. Paul was simply number 5, number 50. Or number 500, or some such number. From one barrack prison to another, Onesiphorus went about seeking for Paul day after day, week after week, often insulted, often threatened, often ill-used, often, no doubt, arrested, detained. Till at last his arms were around Paul's neck, the two old men were kissing one another and weeping to the amazement of all the other prisoners who saw them. Noble-hearted Onesiphorus, we bow before thee. Our Father, today I want to thank you for the men and women you have brought into my life, not just in my own family, but in your family. Those younger and those older, those married and those single. Not one of them needed me to spell out the details of where I was. They seemed to know, and they always cared. I thank you for wise counselors in my life along the way, for faithful elders, deacons, church members, neighbors, long-time friends whom I may never see again on this earth. They are Onesiphorus to me. They were not ashamed of my chain. I pray that these men and women, in the process of getting an education, will also cultivate a heart. It's terry cloth. Tender and full of mercy. Be glorified in our lives, our Father, not just when we lead and teach and preach, but when we lean over and put our arms around another and bring cool refreshment to their lives. Be glorified. The matchless name of Jesus. Everyone said.